Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Welcome to The Untold Story, everybody. I'm Martha McCallum. It's great to have you back with us today. And I'm especially excited about today's podcast because I've got Lucas Tomlinson, my friend and fabulous reporter for Fox News, here with me in New York.
This is great, Martha.
It's
great
to
join
have you here. Obviously, you've been watching Lucas's coverage in Israel. He is a longtime Fox News correspondent, and he was recently in Tel Aviv. He's a 2021 grad. I'm sorry, I just almost made you much younger.
That'd be
2001
great.
Graduate of Annapolis, served in the U.S. Army's 3rd Brigade Combat Team, 10th Mountain Division in Afghanistan. Obviously, he has spent a lot of time in the Middle East and is now there as a correspondent for us. So, Lucas, what I love about you is that you are so poised and detail-oriented, but you also bring your own background to your coverage, having served our country. So I'm always very proud and excited to talk to you. So it's good to have you here today.
Well, thank you so
much,
Martha.
You've been all over. You're really, the past year or so, you've been covering all. So, you know, just give us a sense of what the last year and a half has been like for you as a reporter at Fox, because you were at the Pentagon and now you're just all over the globe.
Right. Things we were talking about at the Pentagon, now I'm reporting and experiencing firsthand. I arrived in Ukraine on February 3rd, 2022, weeks before the invasion. So the story back then was, will Russia invade? Of course, we know how that turned out. But it spent over 2 months last year in Ukraine reporting on two separate trips, two separate occasions. And then 1 week after this horrific massacre in Israel, got the call, we need you in Israel. And the next day I was on a plane to Tel Aviv and reported from Israel for 3 weeks. And, you know, with a small little country the size of New Jersey, although little Sparta, I would add, the bravery and the tenacity of their forces fighting back after that horrific massacre. It was just an incredible experience, not just getting down near the front lines in Gaza, but really just talking to Israelis all over the country, and including American students. And I even had the chance opportunity to interview some American firefighters, guys that just, you know, they saw the massacre and they said, I have to do something. When I heard about these gentlemen, after interviewing some refugees, it was just an offhand remark. Oh, you know, there's some American firefighters here. I was like, got to talk to these people. So it was an incredible experience.
Tell me about that, because those kinds of stories take all of us right back to 9/11. We remember firefighters coming, rushing to
right here in New York,
to, you know, support their brother firefighters here in New York after they had lost over 300 of their own on 9/11. So I would imagine that it feel a little bit like post 9/11?
That's what all the Israelis say. Not only do they compare the massacre to the Holocaust, which Israelis say they've never done in the 75-year history of their nation, but when it comes to 9/11, Bibi Netanyahu has said this is like 20 9/11s, just because Israel is only a size of, it only has 9 million people. So when you look at 1,200 massacred, killed, and of course the hostages, which I still, do you feel, Martha, sometimes we still don't talk enough about the hostages?
Absolutely.
Right. 240 hostages, you know, up to 10 Americans being held hostages, children, up to 30 of the hostages are children. And also, I think an unreported part of it, 35 of the hostages are Thai farm workers from the kibbutz.
Yeah, in fact, I was just reading a story this morning in the Wall Street Journal about, I think his name is Bipin Yoshi, a young man that they profiled whose family is trying to trace his last steps. They believe that he saved people who he was hiding in a shelter with.
The
they were at the concert,
yeah,
and that he threw one grenade out. Another grenade went off in the room. There were injured and killed. He tried to get the people who were okay to move to another location and to try to save them. they think that he may be in custody, but they don't know. He may be dead. And his family, they're Nepalese, and they have not a lot of resources to get their word out. But you hear this heartbreaking story of their son, who to them and to others in this situation, heroic actions. And they feel like nobody is paying any attention. And I couldn't agree more. I mean, every day in our meeting in the morning, I just keep emphasizing, you know, what about the hostages? What about their faces, their pictures? Right. Show them, show them, show them.
And sadly, pictures that are being torn down on the streets of New York.
It's unbelievable.
It's sick. It's sickening.
So why do you think that is? Is it just, are there just so many dynamics that the hostages are get second tier attention?
I think it's hard to get the imagery out of, you know, you're seeing all the footage from Gaza. You see the airstrikes, you see the Israeli forces, you know, some journalists, our own brave, intrepid Trey Yingst has gotten into Gaza a few times, but mostly we're seeing this from the lens of Israeli forces, from drone video, the airstrikes, cameras mounted on helmets from the Israeli forces, from their commando units, the Golani Brigade, Givati Brigade in the Southern Command there that owns Gaza. We're just not, you don't see the hostages. Besides a few of the hostage videos, I think because you don't see them, certainly with television, it's a harder topic to talk about because you just don't have the imagery. But it is horrific, including the hospital, Shifa Hospital, where they saw a table, a chair where they believe hostages were. The Israeli forces finally got in there. It's also uncomfortable. I think hostage death, refugees, these are all horrific things. Hostage, I would say you take it another level. I personally, I think just a lot of people are uncomfortable talking about hostages.
I think you're right. And I think where, you know, the U.S. government is supporting Israel in this mission to eliminate Hamas. This is a very tiny area. So that means that we may be supporting an effort that may lead to the death of some of these hostages. And I think that's one of the reasons that I think early on it felt like there was a number one priority, which was killing Hamas.
Sure.
And then a number two priority of getting who you can out of there. These are the difficult decisions that are made. You're a deep student of history. Right. So what do you think about that dynamic?
Martha, you have 300 miles of tunnels underneath Gaza. This is an area that is twice the size of Washington, D.C., an area. And the idea that there's a labyrinth, a spider web of tunnels underneath. You hear from Hamas that some of the Israeli hostages have been killed, but you haven't, it's the big unknown. It's a mystery. It's tough. It's a tough mission because the Israeli force has been very clear, and the population, by the way. I mean, I spoke to people from all walks of life, pretty united in, for obvious reasons, in wanting to destroy Hamas. Ella Waldman, I spoke to, who is a tech mogul, whose daughter and boyfriend were killed in the music festival massacre.
That was a very moving interview that you did.
He wants Gaza leveled. I mean, this is Old Testament. Israel is not ready for forgiveness right now. This is a war. They want to see Hamas destroyed, eradicated. And that's why they've severed Gaza in two. That's why they're not stopping until Hamas is completely crushed. It's going to be very difficult. Speaking of history, the history of urban warfare. From World War II to Hue in the Vietnam War to Fallujah to the 9-month Battle of Mosul against ISIS. You know, that was about, 5,000 ISIS fighters that were holed up there in Mosul for those 9 months. Now we're talking about, up to 30,000 Hamas fighters. It keeps going and going.
Say that again. There were 5,000
ISIS fighters holed up in Mosul. Granted, the Iraqi forces, I don't think anybody would compare the Iraqi forces to the Israeli forces. 5,000 ISIS fighters in Mosul, the second largest city in Iraq, whereas today you have upwards of 30,000 Hamas fighters holed up in this dense area. And there have been a few people who said, what's taking so long? What's going on? The Israeli officials I spoke to, from the military to the government, to even some of the people, they have to go slow because you're not just fighting on the land. You're fighting subterranean. Mm-hmm. You're having to go into these tunnels. You can't go in so quickly that an assault force from Hamas comes up behind you. That's why it's this slow, they're slowly strangling and cutting off the head of the snake.
And some of the strategy of the tunnels, as I understand it, is to entrap Israeli soldiers.
Big time.
So they want them to come down there because they know the map better than anyone.
Sure.
And they know how to outflank them, essentially.
Totally. We've seen it with some of these mechanized formations that have come in. There's Merkava tanks. You see a Hamas fighter pop up from a tunnel, run in place, almost like the old limpet, sticky bombs from like World War II style on the side of the tank, run away. They cannot go so quickly that these tunnels are still there. You cannot have, you can't be outflanked, as you mentioned. You can't have Hamas guys popping up from behind you. That's why this is slow. It's methodical. But it's also why you're seeing so much destruction, because, hey, if you know, Hamas is firing at you from a building, they're certainly going to take a look and try their best not to kill civilians. But if you're under attack, it's not much of a decision for the Israeli forces.
So what kind of, you know, there's a lot of interesting reporting on the command center, the Israeli military command center, very sophisticated, able to sort of have a wall of TV screens where they're looking at a number of different areas. They can determine what, you know, if they see a group of Hamas terrorists or militants that they want to take out, they can determine what's the best weaponry for this, what's the most precise, how can we use it. So Hamas has the backing of Iran. Do they have technology down there that is anything like this?
No,
or are
nothing.
They just literally fighting blind?
More or less fighting blind, but the advantage is to Hamas, despite all the technology you mentioned. And yes, Israel, they're tracking phones. They can turn on the phones. They have 500-pound bombs and door knockers, they call them, where they can hit the top of the building. Mm-hmm. And it's not going to destroy the building. It's just going to scare the living, you know what, out mm-hmm. of people to run out of the building. That said, all the technology, Shin Bet, their domestic security agency, Israel can track all these Hamas fighters, go after the leadership. Hamas is burrowed inside these buildings. And despite all the technology, if you're an Israeli commando with Sayat Metkal, it's like their Delta Force or Sayat 13, their Navy SEALs, you still have to go door to door, house to house. If you and I ran into 1211, which we are now in this building, and said, oh, we have to go building by building, room by room, looking for people. Mm-hmm. All the technology in the world is not going to prevent it. Hamas has the advantage. They're on the defensive. They're the ones hiding behind those doors in those buildings, and they need to be rooted out. And it's a form of warfare that, frankly, hasn't changed much in decades.
Yeah, no, that's so interesting. You talk about the door knockers, like Israeli forces dropping sort of a light bomb,
right,
for lack of a better
correct.
Word, on top of a building, which basically is a warning
right.
to all
shakes
of the residents, the citizens of that building, that they have time to get out. The next one will be a destructive.
It'll be a 2,000-pound satellite guided bomb that will destroy the whole.
Yes, but it goes to the, you know,
trying not to kill civilians.
Exactly, the intention of the IDF to kill as few civilians as they possibly can.
The untold story continues right after this.
The Fox News Rundown, a contrast of perspectives you won't hear anywhere else. Your daily dose of news twice a day. Featuring insight from top newsmakers, reporters, and Fox News contributors. Listen and subscribe now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.
Backing up to the big picture question, what's going on here? I mean, Hamas says, you know, we don't worry about water and electricity. We also don't worry about martyrs. That's part of our faith. And we're doing this not to rule Gaza. We're doing this to rule the region.
Right.
And that means eliminating Israel, obviously. Right. So where do you see this going? Because there are other players in the Middle East who don't want Iran to have that kind of power.
Well, we just saw that big Arab summit in Riyadh last weekend, and there were some non-Arabs that showed up. It was the president of Turkey. You also had the president of Iran showing up in Saudi Arabia for the first time in 11 years. Now, that all said, it was notable that the Saudis, the Emiratis, would not sign on to this communique about Israel committing war crimes. You know, they put the brakes on some of the harsh language, but Saudi has normalized relations with Iran. There's been a lot of focus on Israel's growing ties with Saudi that prompted this war. I don't think there's many doubt from the experts to say that is certainly what prompted this. But in terms of the end game, it is just going to be a slog. There's just nothing clean about urban warfare. And Hamas, when you're hiding behind civilians, when you have a command center under a hospital, when you're shooting on your own people, the Palestinians, as they flee Gaza, when you're putting weapons and fighters and ambulances, that is tough to overcome. And certainly when it comes to public perception, when it comes to social media, people would say people on TikTok are not getting the full picture. They're not getting the balance. They're not getting both sides. They're not getting, I mean, going out on a limb here, Martha, when people are writing, you know, from the river to the sea, and then they're asked which river, and they get no idea. And apparently they don't listen to gospel music, and they don't even know what the sea is. It's that's one of the big tragedies. You know, being in Tel Aviv, it's 40 miles from Gaza, and you know, this is the same distance from New York to Baltimore. Mm-hmm. You still have rockets. Talked about how this ends. The fact that we are 35 plus days into this war, weeks into this ground invasion, and Hamas can still, does that surprise you, Martha, can still launch these rockets? It surprised me. They still
have an endless supply from Iran and from North Korea.
Like it could go on
for a very long time.
And you saw what they did with these rockets. And they cut the water pipes to build some of these rockets. They took all the water pipes that were donated. Remember, Israel's supposed to supply the water and the supplies into Gaza. That was part of the Camp David Accords from the late 70s. And so they've, taken, first of all, how they built all these tunnels, where'd all the cement come from? Where'd all these product come from? The financial backing came from Iran for sure. But in terms of supplies, some of this does come from the West. And the fact that they've turned all the cement, all these products into, weapons of war bases, it's startling.
Is there any hope for the Hamas, Iran, Hezbollah cause or their desire to wipe Israel off the map through war from the north and Hezbollah, from the south, inside from Hamas, and from the east coming from the Houthis? I mean, I've talked to a number of Israelis who say, yeah, I'm actually worried about that for the first time in my life.
Sure. Well, I mean, fighting a two-front war is never easy. And certainly Israel has their hands full with Hamas at the moment. We're still not seeing Hezbollah going in big. You're seeing the anti-tank rounds, the rockets being launched from Lebanon, but you're not seeing a big push by Hezbollah. Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, you heard his speech a week or so ago. Some critics were saying that some of the language on college campuses was more insightful, it was more devastating than what they heard from Nasrallah. He regrets the war. He's publicly said he regrets the war from 2006. Mm-hmm. He did not know that Israel is going to come so hard. And if you're Nasrallah, if you're Hezbollah, and you're looking what Israel is doing into Gaza, and in fact, we just heard the Israeli defense minister warn Lebanon, warn Beirut, you see what's going on in Gaza, right? This could be you.
And unlike Hamas, Hezbollah has tried to really be a government.
Sure.
And, allow, I think, a little bit more freedom mm-hmm. than the kind of situation that the people in Gaza live under, where they have, basically it's like the mullahs in Iran.
Right.
They can't really do anything. Women wear hijab wherever they go. So Nasrallah wants to hang on to his power. He has a little bit of a political interest in making sure that the memories that people have from 2006 aren't revisited.
Right. And survival. I mean, at the end of the day, these tyrants, they do want to survive. They're not all fatists, some are, but he wants to survive. And
fascinating. It's always great to talk to you, Lucas. I could talk to you for hours. But before we go, I do want to ask you about last night. This is going to come out on Friday, so it'll be a couple days ago. But you had a really special night last night and a ceremony honoring our own Benjamin Hall in the name of someone who's very special to you.
Yes.
So tell everybody about that.
What a great honor. The Fund for American Studies supports young journalists. And one of the awards given is the Kenneth Y. Tomlinson Award. My late father, who was editor-in-chief of the Reader's Digest, he was former director of the Voice of America under President Ronald Reagan, and I might be a little biased here when I say I think helped bring down the evil empire. Mm-hmm. We forget in this day and age before the internet, it was shortwave radios that people were huddled to behind the Iron Curtain, grasping for the truth, wanting to hear what is really going on about their leaders, about their population, about their culture. So to go last night, to come up here to New York, to have Benjamin Hall, our own the greatest hero that we have at Fox, and to present him with the Kenneth Y. Tomlinson Award, named after my father, to Ben Hall. It was very special. And it was great to see Ben also, because, you know, he lives in London now. So it was just, it was a very special evening. And Ben, as he does so well, as our viewers know who watch him on Fox, he just had some incredible remarks about the importance of reporting, why you have to go to the front lines, why you have to push. It was very, very special. He talked about, you got to smell it, you got to see it, you got to be there firsthand. And of course, resilience. You can't talk about Ben Hall without thinking of that word, because let's face it, Martha, how many people do we know get blown up and bounce back, and to handle it the way he did, to get smuggled on to that train from the Polish prime minister. I mean, Hollywood couldn't make this up. Thanks to Jennifer Griffin, Save Our Allies, and this cohort of special operators who had the year prior pulled all these interpreters and all these Americans out of Afghanistan, to have a team to be able to go into Ukraine under 24-hour shoot-to-kill orders, curfew, and to get smuggle him out on an ambulance. And the whole time, Ben is doing it with a smile. Jennifer said that he was saying please and thank you to everybody, and to be stopped at these checkpoints, they unwrapped his bandages. They didn't believe he was in the condition he was because of the smile on his face. And to have to go through that without pain medication, and just to bounce back. I mean, he would be forgiven, right, if he was just going to repair, retire back to London, never to be heard from again. The fact that he's out reporting his piece from the Invictus Games in Germany.
Yeah.
Here he is, a wounded journalist interviewing wounded heroes, wounded soldiers, Marines on the battlefield, from the battlefield, taking part in Olympic style games in Europe. It was just incredible to see him. It meant so much.
I think he is just so extraordinary. And listening to you remind everyone of those stories, I would just recommend that everybody, if you haven't read Ben's book, Saved, it is an incredible story and an inspirational story. And he was not done living.
Right.
And he has proven that day after day. And he also is an English gentleman through and
completely.
Through. And that's why when he has like limbs that are, you know, hanging on by a thread, he's still saying please and thank you to the people who are helping him. But you know what? Those people who helped him, and they were extraordinary, from Jennifer Griffin to Save Our Allies to executives at this company and Amen. People in the State Department who were involved
True.
In getting him home.
Good point.
He has rewarded them a thousandfold.
And if I could say one more thing, Martha,
please.
And the fact that in the book, which is incredible, as you mentioned, you know, his own father was rescued by the U.S. military.
Yes.
In the Battle of Manila in World War II, 6,000 American GIs killed and wounded fighting the Japanese. His father's own father, mother, grandmother, aunt, uncle were taken captive. As a 12-year-old, he had to take care of and support his three younger siblings for about 4 years. And when he saw the Americans, he ran toward them, snipers firing, rounds cracking all around. He runs, and the 37th Division, the Buckeye Division, rescued him. He was so grateful. And here's Ben now, you know, 70 years later, getting rescued from the U.S. military. And you're so right to mention not just our executives here at Fox, but the U.S. military. And, you know, of course, the U.S. forces cannot go into Ukraine because of restraints. But the fact that, you know, from John Kirby to the White House, there was a Black Hawk waiting, that if they could get to the border, the U.S. military is going to save Ben, take him to Landstuhl, where hundreds, thousands of our brave soldiers, Marines, over the years have been taken from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The fact that the U.S. military open that up to Ben, I don't think he'd be alive today without him.
It's absolutely extraordinary story. And thanks for recounting it and for telling us about the award last night in honor of your dad, who had an extraordinary career and has a pretty terrific son. So, Lucas, it's always great to see you. Thanks for coming to New York. And
Martha, great to be here. Thank
we'll
you so much.
Continue the conversation. Thank
Always.
You. That's The Untold Story for today. I'm Martha McCallum. We'll see you next time.
You've been listening to The Untold Story with Martha McCallum. Don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Make sure to rate and review. For more podcasts, go to foxnewspodcast.com. Listen ad-free with a Fox News Podcast Plus subscription on Apple Podcasts. And Amazon Prime members can listen to this show ad-free on the Amazon Music app.
This is Jimmy Failla, inviting you to join me for Fox Across America, where we'll discuss every single one of the Democrats' dumb ideas. Just kidding. It's only a 3-hour show. Listen live at noon Eastern or get the podcast at foxacrossamerica.com.